I've been struggling.
You've been struggling?
Yeah. When I, habitually when I get sick, I just have trouble keeping a good schedule. Mm-hmm. I can still keep it to some extent, but I'm foggy, muddled. Mm-hmm. I can't sit as long.
Well, you can, though, practice observing your own mind.
Yeah.
You may not have the same degree of stability of attention that you would normally have, and you may not have the same degree of clarity, but you can still practice keeping some portion of your awareness turned inward on the state of your mind. And particularly if you're feeling unwell, that's a very good opportunity to notice what happens in your body and how your mind reacts to it. And of course, how your mind reacts to its reactions to your body. So, you know, there's always something. There's always some way to practice.
I have been able to do that, during the day, just during the day, mm-hmm. as I'm going along. Like I keep noticing, just coming back to I'm wanting something. Mm-hmm. You know, wanting this or that.
Yeah.
And that's what causes problems.
Well, that's good. It's good that you remember that. So that's a thing that how well our mind functions is dependent upon our bodies, unfortunately. And the nature of bodies is that they do have these problems. But it's interesting that the things that we're cultivating can still operate even as the quality of the physical support for the mind deteriorates. And it's very interesting as master meditators and teachers, as they age and they go through some of the changes there, sometimes with all chronic diseases, sometimes even Alzheimer's and things like that. But they're still able to maintain the most important aspects of the mental cultivation that they have carried out in their lives. And it's reflected in how well they deal with their processes. So, in a sense,
did you like that tune?
It's very catchy. So, there's always, no matter what happens in life, no matter emotional upsets, sickness, whatever, once you get the essence of the practice, you just keep on practicing. You just go with whatever is happening. So I think you've gotten the idea of that. Gotten just that. Yes.
I have a similar question. I've been sick for 3 months, and I've meditating with a group or even with just one friend has been great because my physical experience is so much more intense than usual. Mm-hmm. It produces greater effects. Meditating alone tends to produce bad effects that I find myself crying, resisting, like the physical things that are happening in my body and the mental things spinning around it are so much that it's like often a bad experience. And I was wondering if you thought it would be that there was some benefit to those practices that feel like they're not doing anything, or whether if it feels like it's bad, I should just meditate on things for now.
Well, you see, whenever you say about your practice that it's bad, that suggests you have some certain expectation of how it's supposed to be. And really the only time that you would say, that I would say that your practice is bad or not good, is when you when you're off track completely, when you're not really practicing, when either you have given up on practicing, or more often what's the case is that you slipped into a mistaken track. You're focused on, well, I have to have this kind of result. And this is what I'm supposed to be doing, and this is the kind of result it's supposed to be producing. And if it's not, then something wrong. Do you know what I'm saying here?
Yeah, but it's still a little bit confusing to me that, like, I guess we do the practice because, you know, even if any given sit might not feel good, that, you know, we expect the practice itself to be beneficial, mm-hmm. and if a particular practice weren't beneficial, then we should stop.
Well, the practice itself will always be beneficial. I have never had any experience where the practice isn't definitely genuinely beneficial. But you can confuse the tool with the task. There are a number of different tools we use, like, for example, keeping your attention on a meditation object. And that's a tool. The task, really, is to learn to be in the present moment, to overcome the tendency of the mind to constantly move around trying to find something entertaining. And more than anything else, the task is to, through being in the present moment and through stilling your mind, the true task is to become aware of what's actually going on in your mind. That, you know, and no matter what's happening, in every moment, this moment is reality. If you want to understand the true nature of reality, it's staring you in the face every single moment. It's always there. This is the reality. So we use these various tools to bring that into focus so we can see it and understand it better. But sometimes the tools, there's certain conditions under which the tools just don't work as well as they usually do. But don't lose sight of what it's really about is being present with what's happening, investigating it through just mindful observation. And that's something that I think so long as you have some vestige of consciousness, you're capable of. Right? So, does that help?
Yes, definitely.
Good. It's a good topic, though. You know, we like to think of our practice when our minds are clear and everything's going well. That's really good practice, but our life isn't like that.
So. I was just going to ask you about, you know how the Buddha says that there are four postures, sitting, standing, walking, lying down?
Yes.
I've never heard a teacher really talk about meditating in a lying down posture, maybe because people tend to go to sleep or it's really harder to stay focused, but it seems to me if you're really sick and your body isn't capable of, you know, sitting for any length of time, that it might be a skill to learn.
Absolutely. And really the only problem with the laying down posture is the tendency to fall asleep. So, and of course, you know, when somebody's learning to meditate, you know, if you had them start out lying down, they might just learn to fall asleep. Well, and so long as there's some, so long as there's not some good reason for lying down, you probably are better off meditating in an upright posture, whether you're sitting or walking or standing. But the lying down, you know, it's called the lion's pose. You often see, I have Buddha images in my home of the Buddha in that particular posture. He's lying on his right side, his knees slightly bent, his left arm resting along the side and his leg. And usually it shows him with his hand, you know, supporting his hip. And that is, in fact, the meditation posture that the Buddha is described as using a number of times. As he got older, he suffered a lot of, you know, I use the word suffer in the ordinary sense of the word. He suffered a lot of physical decline. He had back problems, he had digestive problems, he had severe dysentery in the last few months of his life. And then, of course, there was his final illness. And there are a number of accounts where he's described as meditating in the lion's pose, or lion's posture. And that's the posture that he meditated in his final moments. He said to lay down in that posture between sal trees that were blooming out of season, and then from the first through the eighth jhana, and back down, and then back up to the fourth jhana, and that's where he passed away. So it's definitely a legitimate meditation posture. When you're sick, yeah. I mean, as a matter of fact, when you're sick in bed, that's not a time to say, oh, I can't meditate today because I'm sick in bed. It's probably, at least the way I've taken it, is it's a time when, since I can't really do anything else effectively, I might as well get a lot of practicing. You know? And I do that. So it's definitely a good posture to do that in. And also, I very often I wake up in the morning and I'll meditate. I'll just stay in bed. I won't get out of bed and go sit. I'll just arrange myself comfortably and I'll sit in and meditate. So it's a great posture to meditate in. When you do it first thing in the morning, I was going to say, when you do it first thing in the morning, you really don't have any risk of falling asleep. There is that transition, you know, you've been asleep, and you can fall back into a dream-like state. But if you arouse yourself beyond that point, you're refreshed. You've been sleeping all night. The odds of you falling asleep, meditating, lying down, are pretty small, at least compared to what they would be at 3 in the afternoon. So, good afternoon to all of you who came in a little bit later. And I'm entertaining questions right now. So. Please offer us all your questions or comments. Yes?
I'm not sure if I understand how I can relate to karma in everyday, daily kind of fashion.
Well, what does the word karma mean to you?
I'm at a loss.
Well, okay. It's a difficult word. It has a number of different concepts attached to it, and it's interpreted in a variety of different ways. So, the basic idea, the common thread in all the different ways of understanding karma, is that everything you do has consequences. And I think that's a pretty simple and obvious concept. I carry it a little bit further. Not only everything you do, but everything you think and everything you say has consequences. And that's essentially what we mean when we say karma. Now, different people will interpret that in different ways. And some of those ways are some of those ways are at much greater variance with our ordinary experience than others are. And so that's why I was asking you what you meant by the word karma, or what you've heard about karma. The concept of karma, it comes from the Sanskrit root meaning action. And as a doctrine, it goes back many thousands of years as a part of the Hindu Vedic tradition. In the Brahmanic tradition, the Brahman caste was responsible for carrying out a variety of rituals. A Brahman was to keep three fires lit perpetually in his home. And Brahmins performed rituals that had to do with just about every aspect of the ordinary village life in ancient India. Brahman was often paid to perform rituals by people, by farmers or herdsmen, for the sake of their flocks and their crops, and all sorts of things like that. And part of the whole system of castes that existed, and the Brahmins were at the highest level of the caste, was that every caste had its own duties and responsibilities. And the Brahmin had the highest type of responsibilities through the proper performance of rituals. Basically, the Brahmins kept the world going. They kept the sun rising and setting every day. They kept the seasons changing. They kept the rains coming and ending. And they kept the crops growing and everything like that. And so, initially, the concept of karma was that through the action of the performance of those rituals, since this was believed to keep everything going in the proper way, this was the seed for the concept of action and consequence. It was extended to members of every caste performing their duties and responsibilities in the proper way. And the consequences were extended such that when the idea of karma became coupled with the idea of rebirth, is that the quality of your next incarnation was determined by how well you fulfilled all of the duties and responsibilities, and if you were a Brahmin, how precisely and accurately you carried out all of the ceremonies that were your responsibility. This is where the idea came from. And over time, it eventually came to be the idea that absolutely everything that happened was the result of karmic activities in the past. Everything you did, everything you said, everything you thought was a karmic act and would produce consequences, and absolutely everything that happened to you and everything that you were was the fruits of that karma. So that is how that doctrine, that idea, in a very brief way, that's how it developed. At the time that the Buddha was born, these two ideas of the constant cycle of being reincarnated again in another form after his death, and karma as what determined where and how and in what conditions, what kind of body, what kind of society, and everything else. This was very, very firmly and strongly established. The emphasis was still mainly on the actions. Where the Buddha took and changed this idea, and his approach to everything was far more pragmatic, practical, psychological, and phenomenological. And everything had to, everything, he was not interested in theories. He was not interested in religious theories. He was not interested in cosmological theories. He was not interested in any of those theories. He was interested in the actual experience of being a living conscious being and understanding the nature of that. And so he took the idea of karma, he took all of these traditional Hindu ideas. Actually, to call them Hindu is a modern usage. It should be called Brahmanical ideas or Vedic ideas. He took all of these traditional Vedic ideas and modified them to suit what he had learned in his own experience. And so he said, he changed the meaning of karma. He said, when I say karma, I mean intention. And he said, it is not the action you perform, but the intention behind it. This was very shocking, because in the doctrine of karma, as it existed prior to that, a Brahmin could perform a ritual for someone, could despise the person, you know, could be doing it only for the money, but it had no effect. As long as it had no influence, as long as he did everything perfectly and said everything perfectly, it would produce the right result. And the Buddha was very, he said, it doesn't matter what you do, it matters the intention behind it. And he is the one that really extended it in the direction of every thought and every word, every act of speech as well. The other thing is, if he was not, he was putting the emphasis on the effect that your karmic acts of intention had on your own mind. And he was approached by someone from the Brahmanic tradition, someone who had been trained in the Brahmanic tradition, who said to him, some say that everything that happens to us is the result of karma. And is that true? And the Buddha said, no, not, that's not true. There are all kinds of causes for the things that happen to you. But the person that it happens to is the result of your karma. You create yourself. And from the point of view of the Buddha's original teaching, karma means the intentions, the mental acts, the mental processes that are continuously going on in our mind that continuously form and determine who we are. So that when this, and we see this in the world, that the same thing can happen to two different people and they respond in totally different ways. For one, it's a huge problem. For another, it's hardly an inconvenience. So exactly the same thing happened to both. And the Buddha is saying, what happened to those two people is not the result of karma. It is the result of cause and effect. And everything you do produces that kind of cause and effect too. But when he said karma, he was talking about the internal mental process that resulted in who you were. So in looking at that situation from the Buddha's point of view, although exactly the same thing happened to those two persons, karma is what determined the difference between the persons and how one might suffer great suffering as a result, and the other one might not. Does that help to answer the question? Now I point out to you that when there is, you'll very much encounter in the Buddhist tradition the Brahmanical Vedic idea of karma over and over again. You'll also encounter the Brahmanical idea of reincarnation over and over again. And this is really, neither one of these are entirely in keeping with the Buddha's teaching, with the Buddha's own teaching, but they are consistent with Buddhism as it has come down to us. Because Buddhism has divided into a form applicable primarily to lay persons who over the course of the centuries have typically not been highly educated, have not been in a position to engage in intensive study or intensive meditation and practice. And so this is what is sometimes called the lesser tradition, the smaller tradition, village Buddhism. There's a lot of names like this to distinguish it from what's called the Great Tradition, or Virtuoso Buddhism, or the Monastic Buddhism. And within the Virtuoso tradition, these doctrines are examined, the original doctrines are examined and studied in great depth, and understood at a very refined degree of subtlety. So in most Buddhist parts of the world, if you spoke to a lay practitioner, he would say, he would present with you pretty much the Brahmanical Vedic version of karma. That, oh yeah, absolutely everything that happens, that's the result of karma. But if you look into the tradition more deeply, then you discover there is this much more refined, much more subtle, and ultimately much more penetrating meaning. Okay.